If you're just tuning in, my name is Nathan Scott. You are listening to Sunday Morning, and on the phone now is my final guest of 2018. For most Marylanders, he'll need no introduction. In fact, in just about a month from now, he'll be officially embarking on his second term as the head of the Maryland Executive Branch of Government. It's Governor Larry Hogan. Governor Hogan, thanks so much for making the time to be on the show.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So just after your successful reelection campaign finished up in November, there were only about two odd weeks of downtime before you have to really dive back into the thick of things and, resume the day-to-day running of the Maryland government. One question I would like to ask, this is obviously your second time as a candidate making the transition to public office. How has that transition been different from being a first-time gubernatorial candidate?
Sure. It's much different because the first time, I had been a lifelong small businessman who had never held elective office, and our transition was just an enormous task where we had to take over the running of a nearly $50 billion a year operation with 90,000 employees. I had to hire an entire staff and an entire cabinet and really, take the reins of government. So it was quite a learning curve and building of a massive team and putting together a budget, which had to be submitted the day after I was sworn in. So it was a really big task. And not to say that we're not busy this time, but we have a tremendous team in place. We're making a little tweaks here and there, but very little change. The people of Maryland, overwhelmingly, more than two-thirds of them were happy with the direction the state is heading, and honored and humbled that they chose to keep us in place to govern for another 4 years. So we have a transition, and we're working on our legislative package and our upcoming budget, and we're doing somewhat of a transition, but quite frankly, it's not nearly the overwhelming, massive change that it was 4 years ago.
And you mentioned something else about just having to put everything together for the first time. One of the things that really fascinates me, at least, about political office is that compared to a lot of other jobs you can hold, there's really no training period for learning the ropes. Like, you have to basically dive right in and just learn as you go. Is there anything from your first term that either you learned or that surprised you about the job that will impact how you approach your second term?
Well, there's no question that I'm in a better position now than I was 4 years ago and learned quite a bit. I knew a lot about state government and about politics, even though I spent most of my life in the private sector. I did do a four-year stint as a cabinet secretary under a previous governor, Bob Ehrlich. Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew the ins and outs of it and had a lot of good relationships with people on both sides of the aisle in the legislature, with some of the folks in the government. So I wasn't new to it as some, lifelong business folks might be. But we brought it, we put together some experienced hands that had been in state government that had decades of experience, and we're doing a great job. We brought in some folks from the legislature, both Democrats and Republicans, and we brought in a lot of people from the private sector. But I think I'm more equipped and more experienced than I was 4 years ago. And I'll tell you, I'm now the vice chairman and soon to be the chairman of the National Governors Association. So all of my colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, have put me in a leadership position. And I joke, we just had a new governor school out in Colorado where I was training all the new, I joke and call it baby governor school. But I remember 4 years ago, I was this wide-eyed guy coming in like, oh my gosh, this is a lot to learn. And now I'm like the dean of the college. And I was 4 years ago, I was a first year freshman. So you move up the ladder and you learn a lot pretty quickly.
So as the governor of Maryland, you get out a lot. You go to a lot of places, see a lot of people, whether that was on the campaign trail or now officially going into your second term in office. Have there been any issues since you've been out that you feel Marylanders have talked to you about more than others? And on the flip side, are there any issues that you've become more aware of since you've been in office that you wish more people knew about?
Well, it's one of the things that I love most about the job, and it's funny because in talking to some of my colleagues and other people in elective office, it doesn't come natural to them, and they don't really feel comfortable out meeting people and engaging with people. But it's the part I love the most. So I throughout the campaign and throughout the 4 years of governing, I went, you know, pretty much full speed, and I met thousands of people every day and never stopped, and I engaged with people from one end of the state to the other. I love doing that because I get the input from people from all walks of life, and you hear about the things that people are concerned about and the things that are impacting their life. I mean, frankly, this is going to sound self-serving, I guess, but in this campaign for the past few years, what I heard a lot of was thank you, mm-hmm. and we're really happy with the direction of the state, and thank you for cutting taxes, thank you for cutting tolls, thanks for turning the economy around. You know, but I did hear concerns about, you know, we made record funding in the education, but, you know, continue to make improvements. Please help us with our schools. Please, you know, help fix the crime in Baltimore City. Or, you know, people, there are a lot of issues out there. The one that I wasn't as aware of that I am now, that I learned in my first term, because I got to meet so many more people, was, you know, 5 months after I became governor, I got hit with an out-of-the-blue, unexpected challenge personally when I was diagnosed with very aggressive and very advanced cancer. And I had an 18-month personal battle with cancer, which is a tough challenge. But it really was a blessing because I got to meet so many incredible people and their families that were going through tougher battles than my own. And I got to see what it was like for families to go through something like that, and it made me a different person, really. I mean, I spent a lot of time working on cancer awareness and cancer charities, raising money, and it also, quite frankly, made me realize, you know, about the important things in life, and that life is too short, and you never know how much time you've got, and I've always been sort of driven, but I now I go after every single day and try to make the most of it.
And you know, it does really change your outlook on life. I remember a couple years ago, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, and praise God, she's cancer free now. But
thank God, I'm really glad to hear.
She'd been thinking about getting a master's in library science for a while from University of Maryland, and once she had finished with the cancer treatment, she decided, I'm not going to wait anymore. If I'm going to do this, it might as well be now.
Well, that's an awesome story, Nate. And I didn't finish the thought, but that you reminded me, Bill, because of your mom. Mm-hmm. But because I went through that myself, I've heard so many stories like that from so many other people. And they, you know, I guess because I was so open about my battle, nearly everyone, has been touched in some way. Someone that they love, like your mom. Mm-hmm. People talk about a parent or a spouse or a child or a good friend or someone that they care about. I went through it, and they tell me about their stories and how they overcame it or how they battled it, or in the sad cases, how they lost someone. But and that's the one I wasn't really expecting when I ran for governor, that I was mm-hmm. going to battle cancer or get to know it so well. And it's not something I would have ever wished upon myself or anyone else, but it really did, in a strange way. It was a blessing, and it's changed my life and connected me with a lot of people, and I think enabled me to help, maybe inspire some other people, and to help me get out there and try to help others.
Another sad circumstance that we have to address is that of the opioid crisis. It's something we've known about locally for a long time, is just beginning to get national attention. And going into 2019, what are some of the ways that your administration will be further combating the issue, whether that's a legislature that you're looking to push to get new laws on the books, or reinforcing the laws that are already there?
Well, this opioid crisis is probably the most difficult and most important crisis that not only am I dealing with as governor, but that is affecting the nation as a whole from one coast to the other, and it's affecting nearly every single community. It's tearing apart families and communities all across our nation. And when I first started running for governor in the beginning of 2014, it wasn't nearly as out in the discussion as it is now. It was a problem, but not everyone knew about it. And as I traveled around the state, I was somewhat, I mean, you heard about heroin and you heard about opioids, but it was not the problem that everyone recognizes it to be. And I went from not just in the urban areas, but in very rural communities and very wealthy suburbs and just about everywhere. I said, you know, what's the number one problem facing your community? I would sit down with local leaders. In every single case, in every single meeting, they said the number one problem we have is heroin and opioids. And I was blown away by that. And so during the campaign, I started to bring together stakeholders, which I don't think anyone was doing. I know our state government wasn't focused on it at all. But I brought together treatment providers and law enforcement and prosecutors and healthcare professionals and every kind of expert to talk about what can we possibly do about this. And it was the very first thing I tackled when I became governor. I appointed a heroin and opioid emergency task force, which the lieutenant governor chaired. They held hearings all across the state where hundreds and hundreds of people showed up, and they testified about losing a child or about their own battle with addiction, or they talked about the emergency rooms being filled with patients. And so we got all this input, and they made 38 recommendations on changes to the law, all of which we implemented. Prescription drug monitoring. We put in new gang laws, tougher standards on you know, trying to get these things off the streets. We doubled the number of treatment beds. We invested $6 billion into this thing, $600 million, excuse me, which is a massive amount and you know, a huge increase. In spite of all of those things, and we made progress. I became the first governor in America to declare a state of emergency, just like we would in the case of a natural disaster, because
right.
Our worst hurricane and worst flooding didn't kill 2,000 people a year like this crisis did. So we brought together our emergency management agency, all our local and state agencies. We have fought this from every direction, from education, prevention, treatment, interdiction, crime control. And we did dial down for the first time ever, and we're one of the only states to do it, dial down prescription drug overdoses.
Mm-hmm.
We reduced heroin overdose deaths by 20%. But this new fentanyl crisis, which is 50 to 100 times more deadly and more dangerous, has spiked up, and it's just killing people across the state. And I testified in Congress about federal laws, which, by the way, that just got signed into law, passed by the House and the Senate,
mm-hmm.
and signed by the President, and hopefully that's going to help. But I know it's a very long answer, but I'm passionate about this, and it's going to take the federal, state, local governments and the community leaders and faith-based organizations, and everyone is going to have to get involved in this thing, because it's tearing apart families and it's killing people all across the country.
And this is an issue that, of course, will continue to be addressed, which brings me to the final thing I wanted to mention, which is that, you know, as a Republican governor in a blue state, especially in the current political climate, you're a pretty rare breed, though even more so because if you look at likability ratings, you're ranked the number two most liked governor in the United States. I think only the governor of Massachusetts has you beat. Since you've been in office, what are some of the ways that you've used bipartisanship to accomplish your goals, and how are you preparing your office for whoever comes after you, whether they be Republican or Democrat?
Well, you know, that's, thank you for pointing that out. It's flattering. I kind of get red every time when somebody says that. But and it's not really likability or favorability even. They talk about you're so popular. You know, I was like, wow, I wish I was this popular back in high school. But it's really, the poll really was job approval rating. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not they may like me, but really this ranking was they approve of the job that I'm doing. So I think
mm-hmm.
you could not really like somebody, but you say, wow, they're doing a great job. But either way, I'm thrilled. I'm very good friends with Charlie Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, but I've been 1 point behind him for like 4 years. Every quarter they do these polls, and I keep saying, you know, I'm darn it, Charlie, what do I have to do to beat you?
Right, just a healthy spirit of competition.
So, but he's a terrific governor, and we're both Republicans in very deep blue states, and we're similar in our approach. I think the bottom line, I mean, we've accomplished a lot and done a lot of things, and I think people approve of, they like the fact that we've accomplished things for the state and turned the economy around and made progress. But I think they also, in this day and age in politics, when things are so divisive and there's so much anger and vitriol, both on the right and the left, that people are crying out for civility and decency and you know, just common sense bipartisan solutions. And that's what we've been trying our best to provide. From day one in my administration, I've tried to usher in an era of bipartisanship in Maryland. I don't really care about you know, whether an idea is a Republican idea or a Democratic idea. If it's a good idea, we're gonna push for it. And we really have worked together. We don't always agree, but when we disagree, we do so you know, without being disagreeable. And I don't believe compromise is a dirty word. I think you know, listening to the other side and trying to find to reach that common ground where we can all stand together is a lot better than finger pointing and name calling and you know, never get anything done, which is what seems to happen in Washington. So I think a number of people have said, and I think quite frankly, not to sound immodest, but I think we have set an example for the rest of the nation about maybe the way we should be conducting our politics in America today.
If you'd like to get in contact with Governor Hogan to let him know about issues that you care about or find out what he has to say about what's going on in Maryland, there are a couple of ways to get that accomplished. You can go to governor.maryland.gov, see him on Facebook, that's facebook.com/govlarryhogan, or find him on Twitter at @govlarryhogan. Governor Hogan, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. I really appreciate it, and have a fantastic celebration going into 2019.
Thank you so much, Nate. I appreciate it.
All right. That's the governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan. Once again, you're listening to Sunday Morning. I'm Nathan Scott. Thank you so much for tuning in. And until next year, have a great Sunday morning.